The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, May 17th, with new music, by the way. Today's episode is What to Do with the Bad Men. I'm Hanna Rosin, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. In the New York studios, we have the great June Thomas, a senior managing producer of Slate Podcast Network. Hi, June.
Hey, Hanna.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hanna.
So we have a big, big, big announcement. The cabal, that's the three of us and the producers and everyone else, have made a decision. XX is going weekly. Listeners have been asking for years, and so we are finally doing it. We're going to add new voices and perspectives to the show. You can tune in next week for our first new XX. And there's another thing, which is that the name XX is kind of outdated, somewhat for obvious reasons.
You mean the one that, not all women have 2X chromosomes?
Yes. I feel like the name has become increasingly shameful as the politics has passed us.
Yes.
And so we've all grown kind of increasingly uncomfortable with it. So we have batted around about a million ideas. But before we make a decision, we want to hear from you listeners. So if you have any great ideas of new names for the show, please tweet us at Hanna Rosin, at June Thomas, at Noreen Malone, or send it to our email, xxgabfest@slate.com. We would love to hear your ideas. All right.
I just have one thing. So I just want to note, I did make a goof at the end of the last episode. When Noreen recommended a book by Iris Murdoch, I said, oh, her sister. And Iris Murdoch was, of course, an only child. As an only child, I was particularly ashamed for having assigned her a sibling. And yes, as everybody suggested, I was indeed thinking of two other famous writing sisters of that generation, A.S. Byatt, Antonia Byatt, and Margaret Drabble. So thanks, everyone, for being very kind in pointing out my mistake.
Well, and that just makes me want to reread Possession, which I haven't read since I was about, 14.
Read Possession at 14? Wow.
Didn't you read things you shouldn't have when you were young? No?
I guess I did. It just seems so sophisticated. No wonder you're so smart.
I don't think I got it, which is why I need to reread it.
That's probably true. All right. Well, let's start our show. First, we're going to talk about the men, the bad men. They seem to be plotting their post-Me Too comebacks. What do we think about that? Second, Gina Haspel, the sweet-faced overseer of a torture site, probably the new head of the CIA as of this week. What do we think about her? And finally, Marquesa, the clothing line run by Georgina Chapman, Harvey Weinstein's estranged wife, made a comeback this week, a little nervously. What do we think about that? And then in our Slate Plus segment, Noreen, what are we talking about?
We are talking about whether both the concept and the phrase mommy brain are sexist.
Yes. I'm looking forward to that one. Having been accused of mommy brain here and there in my life, I would like to discuss that. Okay, let's jump into our first topic. Here and there, those bad men who disappeared suddenly are showing their faces again. Charlie Rose, Matt Lauer, Louis C.K., they are in small ways testing the waters. Is it too soon? Is it always too soon? Can you ever come back from this kind of thing? And whose job is it to make sure that you are better? So I'd like to start with Charlie Rose, because he's the one that, he's the one that kind of got this ball rolling of what do we do with these men. It was a story in The Hollywood Reporter, and it's almost comically formulaic, these stories. It's like, I think it was Lonely and Brilliant was the pullout quotes for some reason. The image they want to paint is of a giant.
A lion in exile.
Exactly. It's like a cultural giant sitting by himself at a restaurant, looking nervously around to see, is no one talking to me because I'm a pariah? And is that better or worse than no one talking to me because they've forgotten all about me? And then, swoops in the Tina Brown character to come say that, to float a project of Charlie Brown's that he would like to interview. Charlie Rose, sorry, to float a project of Charlie Rose's to say that he would like to interview other men in exile, which, could have been Tina Brown. It's kind of like a wicked Tina Brown idea. So who knows what role Charlie Rose had in it. But what did you guys think when you first read, you first implanted in your head the idea of a possible TV show of, say, Charlie Rose and Matt Lauer sitting across from each other?
My first thought was
discussing what had happened.
Fuck the fuck off. I feel like I could not have more anger and less interest in a project, even though I know business-wise it's probably, you know, would do what television is supposed to do and attract viewers. Come on.
But do you feel that way about Louis C.K.?
Louis C.K., I have a slightly different view about, partly because I feel like everybody knew his failing, his sin. Like, it was an open secret. That doesn't make it okay. But I feel like it was already kind of priced into his reception. And also, honestly, his age makes a slight difference to me. He's 50 years old. He's also reportedly, you know, doing comedy clubs. He's you know, being somewhat humble about it. I have to say that I have never been interested in any of these men. I did not care for Charlie Rose's show and his shtick. I didn't really understand why he kept getting so many jobs. I wasn't a watcher of the Today Show. Most of these men are not people who are of interest to me. Louis C.K. is as close to somebody who's kind of part of like my media diet or my entertainment repertoire. So I do, you know, maybe it's not for the best reasons that I feel slightly differently about him. But come on, it's time we found some new people. These men, you know, we've talked in the past about how there are some kind of due process issues with some of these guys, but there are no questions about any of the people that we've talked about. And I just think it is a pathetic statement about our lack of imagination, our reliance on big names in the era of, you know, big TV, or, you know, the time of television, peak TV, as we call it, when there are just so many shows, that we're feeling that we have to rely on these established names. But you know what? I just don't think that Charlie Rose, who also is 76 as an old, I feel, you know, can mention that. It's time to find someone else. He's not that good. Ditto Matt Lauer. Move on, people.
Right. Well, it's not like they do something that other people can't do. Like, yes. In part, what people tuned in for was like the personality, their reputation, and those have been pretty well tarnished. The idea that we should not lump all these people in together is pretty obvious to me, that like the crimes of a Harvey Weinstein, you know, are to me quite different than those of Louis C.K., right? Like, he's the interesting case because he does have a unique sensibility. His, you know, sins are the farthest in the past. They, you know, are perhaps less severe in certain ways. I mean, they are, I would say, less severe than you know, he didn't rape anyone, right? Like, which in many of these cases did happen. So the question for me with him is, like, how soon is too soon? Like, I think now is too soon. Mm-hmm. And then, like, what is he owed, right? Like, it seems obvious that his comeback will be, like, talking about this. Like, we don't actually want to hear Charlie Rose sit there with Matt Lauer and be like, it was tough, you know, yeah. the seamless options in the Hamptons are not great and I just couldn't go out to the store, you know, but like, because that's what they'll talk about. I think they're both in the Hamptons, just like,
I think they feel the way Tom Brokaw feels.
Oh.
I mean, don't you think secretly that's how they feel? Like, they secretly feel like this is just a bunch of bullshit. I mean, I don't know that that's true, but it does, like, until you get the sense that they don't feel that way.
Right.
Anyway, yeah. finish what you're saying.
It just, okay, so if, you know, if Louis C.K. comes back in 2 years and he's coming back and talking about this in an interesting way, which is how you can sort of picture this happening, like, he does a sort of not funny, funny, but not funny comedy set, and then it gets celebrated as raw and, you know, like, he's a changed man, et cetera, et cetera. Like, I can totally see that playing out in a way that the culture would receive it well. And you know, if Charlie Rose and Matt Lauer did that show, people would just laugh. It would be a troll. It would be, like, ridiculous. But in 2 years or whatever, the culture might be ready to forgive. So I guess my question is, you know, is that the right way? Should it happen in that way? Is it good for us if that happens as a culture, right? If we, like, have some kind of healing around it, like, it's super raw right now. And like June, I get angry at the idea of certain of these men believing that they can make a comeback. If they were to be able to make a comeback, it would be like, well, what did this,
right,
what mattered in this moment, right? Yeah. Like, did this have any impact at all?
I'm interested in your second question, which is, what are they entitled to? You guys are making me think of this a little differently because, you know, what I'm always thinking about is, how comfortable am I with a culture that's merciless and unforgiving, no matter what the crime? You know, I mean, there's rehabilitation for really terrible crimes, like in our spiritual minds, just in the way we want to think of ourselves as people. At least I do. Like, there's always a possibility for redemption and change. We're not at that moment right now. But then your second question, Noreen, is this actually really helps me. You're not necessarily entitled to, like, have your TV show back. You know, like, maybe you're entitled to be a human being. Like, you're entitled at some point to not be a pariah in our eyes. Even a murderer is entitled to rehabilitation. Like we believe in redemption, but that doesn't mean that you get to have your fame back, your status.
Well, especially when, you know, these were these are the guys that we're talking about, in part because they were people who earned many, many millions per year for, you know, and I realize it's silly to say for doing not much, because only a few people can indeed do those jobs, but more people than those three, you know, whatever. There's been no indication from any of these guys that they even feel contrition. You know, there's not been any kind of reparation. There's not been any kind of even apology, as far as I'm aware of. And so you're definitely not getting your $25 million a year contract back right now, buddy.
Well, I think the questions of forgiveness and cultural, like their place in the culture, are slightly separate ones, right? Like, the question of forgiveness, like, it doesn't matter if I forgive Charlie Rose or not. It's actually the women that he specifically hurt. I think that those are the people who, you know, have the difficult problem of wrestling with their own concept of forgiveness and whether they feel that they can do that, right? Like, as a culture, I think it's more about figuring out, like, what are our values, right? And I don't think that the redemption narrative is actually a value that's under threat in America. Mm-hmm. I think that's everywhere, and I think that there is just some signal.
Wait, no, of course we have no patience for redemption at this particular moment. We have no patience for examination of particularities of the crime. This is so not a redemptive moment. Like, the fact that we say we believe in redemptive stories or we like to read about them has no relationship to what we actually do and actions we take regarding people who have done, you know, crimes that we no longer tolerate. We're completely intolerant of it. I have in my lifetime never seen a moment culturally where, you know, we have just decided, and probably for good reasons, because it moves the cause forward much more quickly when the cause has just been stuck, to just push people over a cliff. Like, it's not a redemptive
moment. What is this cliff, though? This cliff is that they've lost their multi-million dollars per year jobs. They're not in jail. They're not, you know, they've not lost their many, desirable properties. What kind of, you know, this redemption that we're talking about, what exactly is it? That they get that job back again? I mean, I don't...
No, they're just social pariahs, that's all.
Well, like, they're still gazillionaires.
This is also, like, we are still in the white hot heat of the moment. If you take the long term, America definitely believes in redemption. Like, okay, maybe Charlie Rose won't be on, his
17
his own,
shows per week.
Right, but he might be on Dancing with the Stars. Like, there are whole culture industries in America built on, like, people, like, crawling their way back up and coming back and, like, you know, it just, I think
we believe in, like, redemptive narratives for show. We don't actually, we are the least forgiving prison culture in the entire world.
True.
We're the only prison culture based on the idea that actually people don't ever really change. Like, in Europe, there is built into their prison culture the idea that people actually do change. You can be in prison for a billion years and be up for parole and you will never get free. So we pretend we believe in redemption, but actually we just believe in stories.
But the prison question, you can't separate out from, like, race and class issues, frankly. And these are exactly the kind of men that, like, America loves to forgive. But, okay, what I'm actually more interested in as, like, a moral question is less these incredibly famous men who we've all talked about and more, let's say, an executive at Nike who's lost his job or
like Blake Fahrenholt. Who's, you know, the member of Congress who had to resign after it was revealed that he spent like $84,000 of his constituents or of taxpayer money to settle a sexual harassment lawsuit, and now just got this six-figure lobbying job. Like, Screw you.
Well, screw him. But what about the person who isn't famous, like is obviously well off, but, you know, not set up for life, right? Like Matt Lauer doesn't need money. And like what we're talking about here is like whether his ego is going to get properly stroked every morning. Like, fuck that.
Right.
But OK, you're a guy with four kids and you've done something bad, right? Like you have... you know, not Harvey Weinstein level bad, but bad enough that you lost your job at a Fortune 500 company in this wave. So what to me, it's more interesting, like, does the culture or do these companies or other companies owe these people forgiveness? Right. Like one of the things that people have been saying over and over in this moment is like people talk about a white man losing a job like it's a death. And that is really striking and upsetting that the language of that is like, you know, it's so severe. But it is true that, like, if you are not a wealthy person and you lose your job and you have a family, like, that is hard, right?
Yeah.
You are not entitled to anything. But, okay, what is the, like, period of time where that person, you know, and how what's the process for that person to be forgiven to get a second chance?
I think that we are in a moment of non-forgiveness and it's probably necessary to move the cause forward.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I had a conversation with a lawyer friend who does workplace employment law. And she said she's seen many, many spurious cases overall in workplace employment, you know, where it's a case of like somebody claims the boss is violating some rule, but in fact, they're just being mean. But almost none of sexual harassment cases, like that almost every case of sexual harassment that she's seen. And actually, she said every case is valid. Like the person was sexually harassed. It's hard to bring those cases forward. So there is an endemic problem in, you know, that we don't see in the news and that hasn't necessarily been solved by where we are now. So I think a temporary moment of non-forgiveness, I can live. I'm okay with it. But I think long-term, you know, even when you look at small communities, as I did in the last Invisibilia story I did, which was a sexual harassment case, a Me Too case, it's nobody's job to necessarily to bring the person back into the community or to figure out what to do with the person afterwards. It's nobody's job to see where they go and if they're just, you know, committing those crimes in lots of other communities. It's kind of the element of the process that we've forgotten about and that we don't really have a good way to deal with it. But we should, or we should think about it, or we should have some, you know, moral reckoning about it like we're doing now. But to have a temporary period where you're just like, enough, fuck them, you know, don't want to deal with them, I think is okay.
Yeah.
It's not like the problem's solved yet.
And I think that we should, you know, say that one of the reasons we're talking about this is that Katie Jan Baker had an interesting piece in the Times where she talked about, you know, she has covered the campus sexual assault crisis. And at first she was kind of like, I don't, you know, like, as long as these people have been dealt with, like, why does it matter? Like, what happens to them afterwards? And then she realized, no, it actually can, there can be a curdling effect, right? When you just sort of, you can create a reactionary culture by this lack of forgiveness, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or by this just totally cavalier attitude towards what do we do with the bad men? Fuck them, you know, like we don't care about them, that it can create something, you know, a backlash or whatever,
yeah,
whatever it is. The other thing that I feel like we're not actually talking enough about is the idea of demotion as a possible punishment, right? Because if it's true, and I think it is, that so many of these crimes are just as much about power as they are about sex. And these are mostly men who are in positions of power over women and other people and using that in a bullying way. That, like, okay, so the executive who gets fired at Nike, you know, maybe doesn't get to make a lateral move. Like, maybe he starts in the mailroom, right, at his next job or whatever it is. Maybe that's one
way. That's an interesting idea, is to demote people, because there's so much kind of shame in that and reckoning with your own loss of power. I mean, again, white man gets demoted, but
right,
still, that is,
right,
that is
right,
not a bad idea. Well, listeners, if you have heard of any positive ways of dealing with the situation seen in your workplace, in workplaces of friends, cases where a community or workplace has found a way to properly punish someone without quite turning them into a pariah, I would be curious to hear them. So email us at doublexgabfest@slate.com. All right. Our next topic, Gina Haspel, as of this taping, which is we tape on Wednesday mornings, is likely to be confirmed as the first woman director of the CIA. She is a career operative, worked at the CIA more than 30 years. She says she was very good at getting secret information in dark alleys, though we don't actually know that much about what she actually did. But we do know that she was involved in one of the Black Site torture programs after 9/11, which she has since said the CIA should not have done. And I think we're mostly fascinated with her because she's a mild-faced, friendly-looking, middle-aged lady spy. Okay, so let's talk about the torture first, since that's the thing. That's the only story that seems to have come out about her, although there are probably many more. June, can you say a little bit about what we know about her role in torture?
So as you say, she's a 33-year veteran of the CIA. She's, you know, all her career she has been an operative, which is to say, not an analyst, not sitting in Langley, but out in the field. She has been a station chief four times, and in 2002, so just to clarify, a year after 9/11, she was put in charge of a site in Thailand where people were suspected terrorists, were rendition, that is just kind of pulled off the streets in places, and taken, and in a sort of situation where very little was revealed, were subjected to what were euphemistically called harsh interrogation techniques, which at this point I think we've stopped hiding from the term torture. And these were...
Although Dick Cheney recently owned it. He said he'd do it again.
Yeah. And, you know, we should say that President Trump has also said that, you know, that he's pro-waterboarding, which is one of these...
He said he loves it. Jesus, he said, I love waterboarding. That's what he said.
And, you know, there some people still do believe that torture can elicit information, which is a view that I think has generally been rejected. In 2014, there was a study, a congressional study, including, you know, that involved people who were generally sympathetic, that found that the CIA had grossly exaggerated or mischaracterized, let's just say mischaracterized, the amount of information that they had gotten under torture. So, yeah, in 2002, she was in charge of a site in Thailand where at least one suspect was subjected to these techniques. And so there's, you know, even though much of her record is still classified, as you said, Hannah, there have been selective declassifications of her record for this confirmation process. But there's a lot about her career that we don't know. But we do know that she was in charge of a torture center.
Although, to get even more granular, she was brought into this torture site after someone had been waterboarded 83 times, a suspect, and had to be rehabilitated. That's when they brought her in for 6 weeks, and the torture she oversaw only happened, I think, three times. So there's sort of detail there about, at least that's the story that the CIA is presenting now, because the CIA has done an unprecedented kind of, for the CIA, it doesn't look like everybody else's public relations campaign, but of trotting out important CIA officials who normally don't like to speak to the press to kind of create a story or a picture about Gina Haspel and support her confirmation.
But to get still more granular, so she used waterboarding less, but she was, by the way, was the person making these calls very much in this situation, and she used it right away, right? So an al-Qaeda suspect, Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri, was brought in, and apparently, like, torture was the first resort, right? Like, on the first day, he was apparently giving up information, and they still went ahead and tortured him, which is a call that she made, right? And the only person to actually protest about what they were doing to this person, to this suspect, was actually the person leading the interrogation on the ground, was the torturer. It wasn't Gina Haspel herself. So on the one hand, she's being like, you know, like she's being set up by the CIA as like, she was like the cleanup torturer. She was trying to, like, you know, wean us off of it. She was the nicotine patch kind of thing. On the other hand, you know, she was the den.
That's good. That's right.
She was the den mother of the, you know, of our Thailand black site. On the other hand, like, seems to me that she was very embedded in this culture and was like that's the behavior of someone who zealously believes in torture, almost, you know, not as a fact-finding thing, but that's like kind of like a bloodlust, you know, reaction.
No, it's not. It's not bloodlust. Your nicotine patch was a better. It's not bloodlust. It's like a creature of the culture. I mean, what I'm thinking about is our expectation of her is that she in the past had been a whistleblower. That's what we're asking. You know, why
where's that from? Oh, you mean we wanted her to be. She wasn't,
we
right?
We want her now to be a whistleblower. She was not a whistleblower. But what we're essentially asking, because she was essentially, you know, doing her duty. She'd worked there for, you know, she's a veteran. It's clear what she's a person who's married to her job, who's worked within the institution, who's not really challenged the rules of the institution. And we don't, you know, we don't really know all the like little details of what she did and what decisions
she made.
Destroyed the tapes. Well, that's actually more disturbing to me is the destruction of the tape.
Right.
But first, the question of we expect her to be a whistleblower, or the culture is expecting that. And can I just ask you guys for a second, do you think that has a gender whiff about it? That we expect a woman, and a woman who looks, has a kindly face like she does, you know, he looks like, you know, the mom of your new dorm mate or something. Like, she has such a this sort of gentle look about her to have taken like our questioning of her is purely moral. There wasn't a lot of questioning about, you know, would you interfere with the Mueller investigation in Russia, which is a totally important question not really asked. It's all about her moral compass. Do you think that is gendered? I don't know that it is. I'm asking you guys honestly.
I think it's definitely is. And I will say, just speaking very personally, that my first response was to kind of fall for that. You know, and it's also we should also note that if Haspel had not been confirmed, the person who was teed up, kind of, you know, the second choice, which was, you know, universally accepted that the person who would be nominated next is another woman, Susan Gordon, who has slightly less, has fewer liabilities because she was an analyst. So she was in Langley rather than in the field. So clearly there is an attempt to bring in a woman. And I think that it's a smart move. I mean, there are certain things. So as much as I decry torture, that I think it's appalling that her role in 2005 in destroying the tapes of the torture, which, you know, which she was enthusiastic about by all reports. There are, you know, for a while I was like, well, look, I think it's really good that that the next director of the CIA should be somebody from inside the CIA. This would be the first time since 1991 when Robert Gates was a CIA, you know, employee turned head. And I don't think it's good to bring people from outside into an organization like that. And it seems that she, you know, very much has the support of the agency. And if you want to have somebody in that position, chances are at this point it's going to be someone who is tainted by their involvement in torture. And let's note that it was considered legal at the time. At the time, it was not, you know, there were findings from, you know, the Department of Justice that these harsh interrogation techniques, as we call them at that time, were acceptable. So for a moment, I was thinking, look, you know, now we're deciding that this isn't acceptable because it's a woman. And I definitely had a moment of thinking, oh, you know, how bad could it be? And I think it was that I had fallen for, you know, her gender. And then I remembered my sort of something that I think the thing that I most regret having said on an episode of XX Gabfest, which was when Christine Quinn did not win the mayoral race. And I was really mad because I thought, oh, so when a woman who's served her time and has kind of done her apprenticeship and is a lesbian, and then when it's her moment, she gets rejected. And like the rules always change when it's a woman's turn. And then I realized, you know, a little bit later when that first like burning response had cooled a little bit. Yeah, you know, one of the things she did in her apprenticeship was support Michael Bloomberg's stop and frisk policy, which essentially just, you know, chose certain sections of the population to subject to certain behavior that other aspects of the other parts of the population weren't subject to. And that ended up with them being in jail, breaking up families, being absolutely ruinous. And all I could see was, but it's a woman's turn. And this feels like the same thing, that I allowed myself to think it's the woman's turn. And instead, I didn't think she's a torturer.
She's totally she's completely benefiting from being a woman.
Absolutely.
It's like, you know, and even the narrative that like she was just a good soldier. It was legal. She was just doing.
Which is true.
There were people who stood up to it, you know, within the organization, mm-hmm. and she very clearly did not, right?
Yeah.
And the point that a lot of people have made is like, this is, and she's, you know, she's in these confirmation hearings. She's saying, on the one hand, oh, like, I think, you know, torture doesn't work, but we got some good stuff out of that guy, right?
Yeah.
So she's the kind of person who sticks her hand up in the wind. Maybe she's not, like, she's a spy. Who knows, like, how much of herself she's really revealing these confirmation
right.
hearings. But, like, she doesn't appear to have the public history of someone with a lot of backbone who would stand up to, say, like, a madman president who wanted to torture whoever he wanted to torture. And, like, just because she looks like she could be my aunt, like, doesn't mean that, you know, I don't know, Hannah. I think it's interesting that you zoomed in on the moral question as being like in some way soft or
not
a question,
the point.
Right? Not the point. To me, it's like the heart of the question, right? Like the CIA, like we know she'll be good at running the place, probably, right? She knows the culture. She seems like, you know, everyone who works there is like super thrilled to get her confirmed. But like, what does the CIA stand for in the world as an actor is like, I don't know, I think kind of an important question. And
yeah. And naming and confirming her says
yeah.
that we don't care.
Yeah,
about
when it. We zoom out to the world, I can see it more clearly, the damage of choosing someone like her despite the debate over torture. When you get closer, I think, man, these are jobs with just a sick amount of moral ambiguity. It's literally right after 9/11. You don't have that much power. Like she's not like a flunky, but she doesn't actually call the shots. She's there at a temporary period.
Oh my God, she has so much power. Are you kidding?
I mean, she did have a lot of power. I think that's again something that's been a little bit elided, that she was in charge of that site, and she has been station chief in some really important CIA operations.
Yeah, and it's true that she doesn't. She, like everyone else in the CIA, will not sign up to the mainstream line that we don't get information out of torture, which has been well, well documented and reported. They just won't give. You know,
mm-hmm.
they'll
right.
all the line the CIA takes now about that is we don't know. It's impossible
right.
to know whether we would have gotten that information without the threat of torture. That's their official line, which she takes too. And I think, I mean, the one thing that gives me comfort, although not from the world perspective, because I think the world perspective is the headline, like American CIA appoints torturer as chief.
Lady torturer.
Lady torturer, exactly. So that's the headline all over the world. But she is on record now saying that it was a mistake.
Right. And that she wouldn't do it again and wouldn't order it again and would refuse orders.
Right. I mean, I also think that she's benefiting from like one of my least favorite kinds of feminism, which we saw yesterday or Tuesday. Kirsten Gillibrand was giving some speech and she said, you know, if it were Lehman Sisters instead of Lehman Brothers, I don't think it would have fallen. Like just the idea that like...
Like people still say that line?
Yes. Oh. She said it yesterday. It got roundly mocked, as it should have. But it like appeals to the worst, like clumsy kind of like women are just better than men. And like sometimes we are. But like the idea that like
if you want something done, ask the busy woman torturer.
Right. Right. Exactly. She didn't need to. She did do it 83 times. She got it done.
Oh, and three.
Sorry, that was really
and
dark.
Right. Oh, my God. Ugh. All right. Well, torture jokes for everyone. That's how we roll. Let's move on to our next very important topic. How do I do this transition?
I told you the transition
red
was going to be bad.
Red carpet dresses. You
I
did
told
say
you.
The transition would be bad. From torture to the red carpet.
From
the
torture
story.
To high heels.
Yeah. Yes. That's good. That is good. That's why you're an editor at New York Magazine. All right. Transition awkwardly accomplished. Let's talk about Marchesa, the red carpet dress brand owned by Georgina Chapman, who's Harvey Weinstein's estranged wife. When the Weinstein story first broke, people backed off from the brand, leery of the association, thinking of Chapman as an enabler. And this week, the brand has made a sudden, as if orchestrated, comeback with Scarlett Johansson wearing the dress to the Met Gala and Anna Wintour defending Chapman in her letter to the editor, repositioning Chapman as a victim and not an enabler. You know, it's rare that we peer into the fashion world here on this show and the kind of machinations of the fashion world. It really just seems arcane. It's like an arcane craft or like mafia dons or something. It's just like they all decide something and they all live on Mars and then they sort of make a decision and then every once in a while it rises to the mainstream. It was a very odd moment. But Noreen, before we dive into the oddness of it, can you just tell us, like, who's Georgina Chapman? What is this brand? Why do we care?
So Georgina Chapman is kind of an English Rose type who was a model and had this fashion line that was not super successful. She started with a friend when she was quite young. It was not super successful. She made very beautiful, almost old-fashioned kind of couture-ish dress.
Pretty dresses for pretty women, as it was described.
Yes.
Very elaborate, though. Very
yes.
elaborate.
Very like you're going to wear it to the premiere of, you know, whatever movie you're in. And then she got hooked up with Harvey Weinstein, who she began dating. And then suddenly Marchesa was worn by a lot of actresses who were in his movies, and then they subsequently would appear often on the cover of Vogue, let's say in a Marchesa dress. So, you know, Harvey Weinstein and Anna Wintour had some kind of a friendship, let's say, or you know, they traveled in similar circles, big Democratic donor circles, power circles of New York. Anyway, the takeaway with Marchesa is that the relevant thing here is that, like, her, and I'm not saying that the dresses aren't pretty, but no one was wearing them in the same way until she married Harvey Weinstein, who maybe made it non-optional for some of these actresses to wear these dresses. And the interesting thing to me about the Anna Wintour rehabilitation of...
Well, say what it is. You know, I'm sure not all of our listeners have read the letter to the editor in this month's edition of Vogue.
Yeah. So you mean that's not the first thing that you turn to on the first of the month? And we should say that it was also accompanied by a profile by Jonathan Van Meener of Georgina Chapman's life now. And you sort of see her selling the townhouse that she lived in with Harvey and, you know, moving upstate and talking about how she didn't know. And so Anna Wintour's editor's letter, you know, says that she firmly believes that Georgina did not know and that, you know, we should not treat her as collateral damage and that, you know, just because she was married to the guy doesn't mean that she should, you know, she should suffer for his sins. So this is sort of a complicated thing, right? Like, should the wife of someone suffer for their sins? But that reading, first of all, like, presumes that Georgina Chapman knew nothing about this, that maybe she just, like, and you know, I'm inclined to cut her some slack and say that she, I doubt that she knew that her husband was raping women, you know? But she certainly had to know that he was pulling strings on her behalf and that sometimes the strings could be pulled in ugly ways. The other thing that's happening in this editor's letter, which Stella Bugby of The Cut pointed out, I think very smartly, is that, like, in some ways, Anna is trying to cleanse her own sins here, right? To say, oh, not all the women who, you know, who helped out these bad men or who promoted or who functioned in symbiosis with these bad men, don't blame them, you know? Like, a lot of these photographers who have subsequently been accused of sexual assault are, you know, all over the pages of Vogue, have had these relationships with Anna Wintour over the years. She, as Stella pointed out in her letter, was she sort of spearheaded the campaign to enable the comeback of John Galliano, who, like, said some pretty anti-Semitic things a few years ago. She seems to always be the first in line to sort of absolve people of their sins. You know, maybe that is because she's the high priestess of fashion, or maybe she just has a, like, she has a vested interest in, you know, making it seem like these people are not that bad because she's in some ways complicit with them. What do you guys think?
To me, it read just like a power play. I mean, I just was skeezed out by the whole thing. Like, it just read like a mafia don writing a letter. Like, this is, I have declared that she didn't know about it. This, you know, these are the new realignments of power, and I'm still in charge. Like, that's all it was about for me. Like, she has no idea what Georgina knows. None of us really have any idea. Georgina is bought into a worldview, which Anna Wintour is bought into, where it's perfectly fine for your husband to strong arm actresses into wearing your dresses. And I mean, can you imagine Anna Wintour ever having a kind of culpability or a kind of being moved to, you know, to reckon with her own complicity in a lot of the sins that are coming out lately against models and with photographers? She's never going to do it. It's just not her thing.
She has to privately, just as a human being. You can't not reckon with that.
But I have
no
idea.
She would never do it publicly.
I mean, she's just such a power operator. Yeah. I have no idea what she does and doesn't do. But also, the profile of Georgina Chapman was quite interesting because much more interesting than the editor's letter because, you know, it had just the right doses of everything. Like, it had just the right dose of kind of childhood struggle, you know? Yeah. She had a hip defect. I mean, she is just stunningly gorgeous, right? But it painted a portrait of a child who was kind of bullied and rejected, which is possible, right? It's possible that there were various ways in which children rejected her. But I was so humiliated, I'm not worthy, and then her protection of the children. All of this is possibly true. Oh, even, did you guys note the best detail in the story? Who does her children have play dates with?
Oh, yes. This is amazing. Huma Abedin.
Yes.
Who gives like great quotes about like what they share and how.
Yeah, her quotes just irritated me the most because it was another trope I can't stand, which is like, she's just a regular person who feeds hot dogs to her children. It's like, I hate that. It's like the Ivanka Trump thing where like it makes you a regular person because you feed food to your children. That isn't, you know. Batali.
Exactly. It's like, well, that would be problematic.
Well, what do you guys think about the notion, though? Okay, like setting aside this weird fashion power thing, which I personally think is just gross.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that I don't work in the fashion industry. But okay, like let's presume that Georgina Chapman knew that her husband was. Let's presume that she thought he was cheating on her, and she sort of turned a blind eye because she was getting things out of this marriage, right? You know, she was getting some measure of independence, of confidence, of success, and you know, she thought it was the actions of a loving husband who was sort of using his connections to grease the wheels for her. If we take that reading, you know, is it unfair for her to be punished for the sins of her husband? If she was complicit to a certain point, but not complicit in a like with sexual assault, let's say.
Yeah, I kind of think so. I mean, as much as I agree with you, Noreen, my gut response is sort of skeeviness.
Mm-hmm.
And that the profile was almost like a joke. I mean, you know, the humble beginnings, her father's humble origins and you know, her good friends, David Oyelowo and Neil Gaiman, you know, making their quotes. And, oh, you know, she only really ever had two boyfriends before she hooked up with this guy, you know, like, whatever.
Do I think she's complicit? Probably not. You know, it's a different level of complicity of kind of turning a blind eye, right? Like you make certain compromises to build a certain life and you ignore certain things about your certain life. And lots of people do that. But instead, the profile of her was, you know, I am unworthy. I'm so humiliated. I'm such a bad person. I have to protect the children. Instead of a genuine reckoning, which, you know, you could create a tiny little space for that, even in a Vogue profile, in which you said, you know, I had to think about the fact of, you know, whether I was complicit in some way, whether my husband strong-armed people into wearing my dresses and how much that had to do with me building my career. And I will have to think about that for the rest of my life. Instead of this orchestrated, shut all the questions down, Anna Wintour's on my team, Neil Gaiman's on my team, like, I have the right team. We're done.
And Huma Scarlett Baden.
Johansson's on my team. Huma Baden. Exactly. It's just like, I have, you know, I have rallied the correct, beautiful people, and I'm back now. 5 minutes later, you know, it's not a model for rehabilitation. I don't know that you know, she needs to be collateral damage to her husband's monstrousness, but this is not a model of truth and reconciliation.
Yeah. And again, you know, it's hard to judge these people, or it's hard to extrapolate from an example like Georgina Chapman, who, you know, will now go, yes, has to move out of her West Village, you know, mansion, townhouse, whatever we call it, and move up to, you know, surely a fabulous farm upstate where she'll be surrounded by her famous friends. Like, she's not really suffering.
Well, she may be suffering. But,
oh, yeah. But I mean, in terms of like existential, yeah, I'm sure she feels very bad. I'm sure it was really horrible. But
she can provide for her family.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, listeners, if you have any thoughts about Marquesa or about Georgina Chapman, please share them with us either on our Facebook page or at XXGabFest@slate.com. So let's do our recommendations. June, what do you have?
Okay, so I have two. One is very limited because you have to be in New York or in Brooklyn. I recently went to do a workshop, an indigo dyeing workshop and sort of stenciling and decorating workshop organized by this place called Curious Corners, which is essentially run by a Japanese woman. And they are sort of 2-hour, 3-hour workshops in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And they are amazing. And if you've ever had just the vaguest interest in doing any such thing, Sayaka-san is awesome and really patient, and you will make something amazing. And it's relatively inexpensive.
I just Googled. There's one on May 26th.
For example.
Maybe I'll see you there.
Wait, so how do you do it? You just make an appointment and then you...
There are two. They do workshops, and then you can do private workshops. So you can also just take your own items for dyeing. You can just bring... It's called Bring Your Own Dyeing, BYOD. But I do recommend the workshops the first time around because indigo is kind of fascinating, and they will... Sayaka-san will show you how. But... More broadly, something that expands a little bit beyond Brooklyn. I think other people have even recommended this already. Certainly there have been segments on the Culture Gabfest about it, but the BBC America show Killing Eve is really good.
No, that's my recommendation.
It's so good.
It's
at first I didn't want to be like seduced by it because I'm not into like, oh God, murderous women, and oh, she's got a... like a sort of weird crush / obsession with a straight woman. Oh, no, I didn't. There was so much I didn't want. And then I started to watch it. Oh, my God, it's so good. And I credit Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Phoebe Waller-Bridge for her involvement because it's just a little bit different and a little bit off. And it's, God, it's so good. And the acting is
amazing.
I agree.
It also... I'm just going to jump onto your recommendation because it's also got sort of variations of Gina Haspel. You know, there's just kind of every variety of the lady spy, from the psychopath lady spy to the kind of genial middle-aged lady spy to the kind of older, you know, career lady spy. I mean, it really has it's a very female show. And I've been watching it along with Handmaid's Tale. Those are the two things that I'm watching right now. And even though there's a lot more killing on Killing Eve, it's just like a lot easier. You know, the torture porn question is not so high on your mind that the way it is this season with Handmaid's Tale, where it's like, does it really need to be this kind of glossy and sexy? It's just clearly like of a James Bond sort of slick feel to the killing, which is somehow more palatable than the kind of emotional depths.
I see Noreen has a response to this.
Well, I just want to know how your dreams are right now. Like, are you just having nightmares?
Well, you know how I cleansed it? I cleansed it by watching the SNL skit about Handmaid's Tale after watching Handmaid's Tale because it just kind of wipes it away.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay, Noreen, you go. I'm going to share June's recommendation.
Okay, well, I have two, so people won't be out in the street. They are both... One is a Netflix comedy special that's already out, and one is an upcoming Netflix comedy special. I think I might have recommended the first Ali Wong special when
it came
out.
We
talked about it. Okay, that's what we did. So her first Netflix comedy special was called Baby Cobra, and she famously was pregnant in it. And on Mother's Day, she dropped her second one where she is pregnant again. And this one is called Hard Knock Wife. And it's very much a sequel to the first one, right? So there was a huge setup in the first one with like how she was making more money than her husband. That like theme comes through again. She talks in very vivid detail about the postpartum body, both her own and a friend's. She makes jokes about race and sex. Again, it's very much, if you like the first Ali Wong special, it's not as sort of like, the first one felt like surprising and inventive, and this is like a new person that you're thrilled to like know about. This one's like, oh yeah, Ali Wong again. So if you like her, check it out. And then the other one, I saw Hannah Gadsby, who did a comedy set called, or a comedy show called Nanette in New York, and it's coming to Netflix, I believe, sometime next month. She is from Tasmania, of all places, which she like makes some good comic hay on in her set. She is really, really, really funny and charming. She is a lesbian comic, and a lot of the beginning of her show is about that. And the first half of the show, you sort of think, like, this is just a really funny person. And then the show takes a turn where she sort of breaks down what comedy is. And she breaks down what comedy is in the context of bad men, right? And like why we, you know, what genius is, what we celebrate, and how you joke about these things and how you don't joke about these things, and what is the work that the joke is doing that it's setting up tension and relieving it. And it's like no comedy set I've ever seen. And comics love to talk about how, like, you know, they're pushing boundaries by like saying things that are in bad taste. And it's like, oh, you're not pushing that many boundaries. Like, I've heard a racist joke before. It's not, you're not like doing anything inventive here. But this was truly inventive. And the reaction in the room was, no one knew what to think about the second half of the show. So maybe I kind of want to, if you guys are interested, I might want to talk about this on the Gabfest. But if not, people who are interested in comedy and, yeah, people who are interested in comedy and feminism and the way those two things can play together and whether they should play together, should check this out. It's Nanette by Hannah Gadsby.
Wow.
That sounds great. Yes. Sounds really great. Do you want me to recommend a novel? I'm reading a great novel.
Yeah.
It's actually very relevant. Sure. It's called Theory of Bastards by Audrey Shulman, S-C-H-U-L-M-A-N, about a primate researcher. It's really fabulous. I'm pretty feminist, too. All right. Well, that is our show today. Thanks to our fabulous producer, Verilyn Williams, to our production assistant, Daniel Schrader. And remember, listeners, we really want your suggestions for a new name for our show. We are trying not to be Double X anymore. We need a great idea for a new name, and we would love your suggestions. So either email us at doublexgabfest@slate.com with ideas, or tweet us at June Thomas, at Noreen Malone, or at Hannah Rosen. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and look for us in your feeds next week.